of injury had already passed, and she only feared the expression of his displeasure. She remembered that the child had been quite well since yesterday. She was even vexed with her for having recovered so soon as the letter had been sent. Then she recollected that he was here, all of him, his hands, his eyes. She heard his voice, and forgetting everything else, ran joyfully to meet him. "Well, how is Annie?" he asked timidly, looking up at Anna as she ran down to him. He was sitting on a chair, and the footman was pulling off his warm boots. "Oh, it's nothing. She's better."
"And you?"
he asked, giving himself a shake. She took his hand in both hers and drew it to her waist, not taking her eyes off him.
"Well, I'm very glad,"
he said, coldly surveying her coiffure and the dress which he knew she had put on for him. All this pleased him, but it had already pleased him so often. And the stern and stony look which she so dreaded settled on his face.
"Well, I am very glad."
"And you are well?" said he, wiping his wet beard with his handkerchief and kissing her hand. "No matter," she thought, "if only he is here. When he is here, he can't and daren't fail to love me." The evening passed happily and cheerfully in the company of the Princess Barbara, who complained to him that in his absence Anna had been taking morphia. "What am I to do? I could not sleep. My thoughts kept me awake. When he is here, I never take it, or hardly ever." He told her about the elections, and Anna knew how, by questions, to lead him on to just what pleased him, his success. She told him about everything that interested him at home, and all her news was most cheerful. But late at night, when they were alone, Anna, seeing that she had regained full mastery of him, wanted to efface the depressing impression of the look he gave her apropos of the letter, and said, "But confess that you were vexed to get my letter, and did not believe me?" As soon as she had said this, she knew that, however lovingly disposed he might be to her, he had not forgiven her for that letter.
"Yes," he answered. "It was such a strange letter. Annie was ill, yet you wished to come yourself?"
"That was all true."
"I don't doubt it."
"Yes, you do doubt it. I see you are displeased."
"Not for a moment. I am only displeased, really, that you seem not to wish to admit that there are duties."
"Duties to go to a concert?
Don't let us talk about it," he said.
"Why should we not talk about it?" she replied.
"I only wish to say that one may have unavoidable business. Now, for instance, I shall have to go to Moscow about the house."
"Oh, Anna, why are you so irritable? Don't you know that I can't live without you?"
"If that is so," replied Anna in a suddenly changed voice, "it must be that you are weary of this life. Yes, you will come for a day and go away again, as men do."
"Anna, that is cruel. I am ready to give my whole life." But she did not listen to him. "If you go to Moscow, I shall go too. I will not stop here. Either we must separate or live together. You know that that is my desire, but for that..."
"A divorce is necessary?"
"I will write to him. I see I cannot live like this. But I will go to Moscow with you."
"You speak as if you were threatening me."
"Why, I don't wish for anything so much as not to be separated from you," said Vronsky, smilingly.
But not a cold look only, but the angry look of a hunted and exasperated man flashed in his eyes as he spoke those tender words. She saw that look, and rightly guessed its meaning. The look said, "If so, this is a misfortune." It was a momentary impression, but she never forgot it. Anna wrote to her husband asking him for a divorce, and at the end of November, having parted from the Princess Barbara, who had to go to Petersburg,
she moved to Moscow with Vronsky. Daily expecting Karenin's reply, to be followed by a divorce, they now established themselves like a married couple. Part 7 Chapter 1 The Lievins had been more than 2 months in Moscow, the date on which, according to the most exact calculations of persons experienced in such matters, Kitty should have been confined, had long passed. But she had not yet been delivered, nor were there any signs that the time was nearer now than it had been 2 months previously. The doctor, the midwife, Dolly, her mother, and especially Lievin, who could not think without horror of what was coming, began to experience impatience and anxiety. Kitty alone was perfectly calm and happy. She now distinctly realized the awakening of a new sense of tenderness for the coming, and for her to some extent already existing, child, and she yielded with pleasure to that feeling. It was no longer entirely part of herself, but now and then lived its own independent life. Sometimes this occasioned her pain, but at the same time she wanted to laugh because of this strange new joy. All whom she loved were with her, and all were so kind to her and so attentive, and everything was presented to her in so pleasant an aspect, that had she not known it must soon come to an end, she could not have desired a better or pleasanter life. The only thing that marred the charm of this life was that her husband was not as she loved him best, not as he used to be in the country. She loved his quiet, kindly, and hospitable manner on his estate. In town he always seemed restless and on his guard, as if afraid lest someone should insult him, or, worse still, her. There, on his estate, feeling that he was in his right place, he was never in a hurry to go anywhere and was always occupied. Here in town he was always in a hurry, as if fearing to miss something, and yet he had nothing to do. She was sorry for him. She knew that to others he did not appear to need pity. On the contrary, when Kitty watched him in company, as one sometimes watches a person one loves, trying to see him from a stranger's point of view so as to realize the impression he makes on others, she saw, even with some jealous fear, that far from needing pity, he was very attractive, by his good breeding, his rather old-fashioned and timid politeness to women, his powerful figure, and, as she thought, his uncommonly expressive face. But she understood him not from without, but from within, and saw that in town he was not himself. She could not otherwise define his condition. Sometimes in her heart she reproached him for not knowing how to live in town. At other times she confessed that it was really hard for him to arrange his life here satisfactorily. Indeed, what could he do? He did not care for cards. He did not go to the club. She knew now what consorting with gay people of Oblonsky's sort meant. It meant drinking and then driving somewhere. She could not think without horror of where men drove to in such cases. Go into society? But she knew that to do so he would have to find pleasure in being with young women, and she could not wish that. Stay at home with her and her mother and sisters? But, agreeable and amusing as the same oft-repeated conversations might be to her, talks about Arlene's and Nardine's, as the old prince called those talks between the sisters, she knew they must bore him. Then what was left for him to do? Continue to write his book? He did try to do it, and began by going to a public library to take notes and look up references he required. But, as he explained to her, the less he did, the less time he seemed to have. And he also complained that he had talked too much about his book here, so that all his ideas had become confused and he had lost interest in them. The one advantage of this town life was that here they never quarrelled. Whether it was that the conditions of town life were different or that they had both grown more careful and reasonable in this respect, at any rate, in Moscow they never had quarrels resulting from jealousy, such as they had feared when they moved to town. An event even occurred of great importance to them both in this respect, namely, Kitty's meeting with Vronsky. The old princess, Maria Borisovna, Kitty's godmother, who had always been very fond of her, particularly wished to see her. Though Kitty was not going out anywhere because of her condition, yet she went with her father to see the venerable old lady, and there met Vronsky. The only thing Kitty could reproach herself with when that visit was over was that for an instant, on recognizing Vronsky's once so familiar figure in his civilian clothes, she grew breathless, the blood rushed to her heart, and she felt a deep flush suffusing her face. But this lasted only a few seconds. Her father, purposely addressing Vronsky in a loud voice, had not finished what he was saying before she was quite ready to face Vronsky, and if need be, to converse with him, just as she conversed with the Princess Maria Borisovna, especially so that everything, down to the lightest intonation and smile, might be approved by her husband, whose unseen presence she seemed to feel above her at that moment. She exchanged a few words with Vronsky, and even smiled at a joke he made about the elections, to which he alluded as our Parliament. She had to smile to show that she understood the joke. But she at once turned to the Princess Maria Borisovna and did not once look round at Vronsky till he rose to go. Then she looked at him, but evidently only because it is impolite not to look at a man when he is bowing to you. She was grateful to her father for not saying anything to her about this encounter with Vronsky, but by his peculiar tenderness to her during their daily walk after the visit, she saw that he was pleased with her. She was pleased with herself. She had not at all expected to find strength to shut down somewhere deep in her heart all memories of her former feelings for this man, and not merely to appear, but really to be, quite tranquil and calm in his presence. Levin blushed much more than she had done when she told him she had met Vronsky at the Princess Maria Borisovna's. It was very difficult for her to tell him this, and still more difficult to go on giving him details of the meeting, as he did not ask anything, but only frowned and looked at her. "I am very sorry you were not there," she said. "I don't mean present in the room. I should not have behaved so naturally with you there. I'm now blushing much more, much, much more," she added, blushing to tears. "But I'm sorry you could not look in through a crack." Her truthful eyes told Levin that she was satisfied with herself, and in spite of her blushes, he grew calm at once and began questioning her, which was just what she wanted. When he had heard all, down to the fact that just for the first second she could not help blushing, but that afterward she had felt as natural and easy as with anyone she might happen to meet, he became quite happy and said he was very glad it had happened, and in future he would not behave as stupidly as he had done at the election, but would try to be as friendly as possible with Vronsky next time he met him. "It is so painful to think that there is a man who is almost my enemy, whom I dislike to meet," said Levin. "I am very, very glad."
Chapter 2
"Well then, please call on the Bolls," said Kitty to her husband, when, at about 11 o'clock in the morning, he came to her room before going out. "I know you were dining at the club. Papa put your name down. But what are you going to do this morning?"
"Only going to see Katavasov," answered Levin.
"Why so early?"
"He promised to introduce me to Metrov. I want to have a talk with him about my work. He is a celebrated Petersburg scholar," replied Levin.
"Oh, yes, it was his article you praised so."
"Well, and then?" inquired Kitty. "Then I may call round at the courts about my sister's case."
"And the concert?"
"Oh, what's the good of my going alone?"
"Oh, yes, do go. They are giving those new pieces. It used to interest you so. I should certainly go."
"Well, in any case, I will come back before dinner," he said, glancing at his watch.
"But put on a morning coat so that you can call on the Countess Boll on the way."
"Is it absolutely necessary, then?"
"Yes, absolutely. He called on us." "Why, where is the difficulty?"
"You'll call on your way, you'll sit down, talk about the weather for 5 minutes, and then get up and go away." "Well, will you believe it? I have got so out of the habit that it makes me feel ashamed. A stranger arrives, sits down, remains a while doing nothing, disturbs them, upsets himself, and goes away again.
Kitty laughed.
But as a bachelor you used to pay calls, she said.
I did, but I always felt ashamed, and now I'm so out of the habit of it that, seriously, I'd rather go without dinner for 2 days than pay that call. It is so embarrassing. I feel the whole time that they will be offended and will say, why have you come when you have no business here?
No, they won't be offended. I will vouch for that, said Kitty, looking laughingly into his face.
She took his hand. Well, goodbye.
Please call on them.
He was about to go after kissing her hand when she stopped him.
Kostya, do you know I have only 50 rubles left?
Well, what of that? I'll call at the bank and get some.
How much?
He asked, with a dissatisfied look familiar to her.
No, wait a moment. She held him by the hand. Let's talk it over. It bothers me. I don't think I spend on anything superfluous, and yet the money simply flies away. There's something we don't do right.
Not at all, he said, coughing and looking at her from under his brows.
She knew that cough.
With him it was a sign of great displeasure, not with her, but with himself. He was really dissatisfied, not because they had spent so much, but because he had been reminded of a matter which, well knowing that something was wrong, he wished to forget.
I have told Sokolov to sell the wheat and draw the money for the mill in advance. We shall have money in any case.
Yes, but I'm afraid that in general too much, not at all, not at all, he repeated.
Well, goodbye, darling.
But really, sometimes I am sorry I listened to Mama. How nice it would have been in the country. As it is, I have worn you all out, and we are wasting money.
Not at all, not at all. Not once since our marriage have I said to myself that things might have been better than they are.
Is that true? She said, looking into his eyes.
He had said it without thinking, to comfort her, but when he looked and saw those dear, truthful eyes questioningly fixed on him, he repeated the words from the bottom of his heart.
Decidedly, I am forgetting her, he thought,
remembering what was so soon awaiting them.
Will it be soon? How do you feel?
He whispered, taking both her hands in his.
I have so often thought so that now I have given up thinking.
And you're not afraid? She smiled contemptuously.
Not an atom, she answered.
Well, should there be anything, I shall be at Katavasov's.
No, there won't be anything. Don't imagine it. I shall go for a walk on the boulevard with Papa. We will call at Dolly's. I'll expect you before dinner. Oh, yes, do you know, Dolly's situation is becoming quite impossible. She is deep in debt and has no money. Mama and I were talking about it with Arseny,
so she called her sisters, the Princess Lvova's husband, and we decided to set you and him at Stiva.
It is quite impossible. We can't speak to Papa about it, but if you and he...
But what can we do? Said Lievin.
Well, anyhow, you will see Arseny. Have a talk with him, and he will tell you what we decided.
I'm ready to agree with Arseny beforehand. Well, I'll call on him, then. By the way, if I go to the concert, I'll go with Natalie. Well, goodbye.
At the porch, Kuzma, an old servant of his bachelor days, who was now managing the household in town, stopped Lievin.
Krasavchik, one of the pair of carriage horses brought from the country, has been reshod, but still goes lame, said he. What are your orders?
On first coming to Moscow, Lievin had taken an interest in the horses they brought from the country. He wanted to arrange the matter as well and as cheaply as possible. But it turned out that their own horses cost them more than hired ones would have done, and they hired horses as well.
Send for the vet. Maybe it's a bruise.
Yes, and what will Katrina Alexandrovna do? Asked Kuzma.
Lievin no longer thought it strange, as he had done when he first came to Moscow, that to go from the Vozvitskenskoye street to Sidsev Vrajik it was necessary to harness a pair of strong horses to a heavy carriage, to drive through the snowy slush a quarter of a verst, to keep the carriage waiting there for 4 hours, and to pay 5 rubles for it. Now all this seemed quite natural.
"Hire a pair of horses to be harnessed to our carriage."
"Yes, sir."
And thanks to the conditions of town life, having thus simply and easily solved a difficulty which in the country would have required much exertion and personal attention, Levin went out, called an izvozchik, and drove to the Nikitskaya. On his way, he thought no more about money, but considered how he could make the acquaintance of the Petersburg scholar who was studying sociology, and how he would talk to him about his book. Only during the very first days in Moscow had the unproductive but inevitable expenditure, so strange to country folk, yet demanded on all sides, startled Levin. Now he was used to it. In this respect, the thing had happened to him which is said to happen to drunkards. The first glass you drive in like a stake, the second flies like a crake, and after the third they fly like wee little birds. When he had changed the first 100-ruble note to buy liveries for the footman and hall porter, he had involuntarily calculated that those useless liveries, which, however, were absolutely necessary, judging by the surprise of the old princess and Kitty at his hint that one could do without liveries, would cost as much as the hire of 2 labourers for the summer months, that is, of 1 for about 300 working days between Easter and Advent, and each a day of heavy labour from early morning till late in the evening. He parted with that 100-ruble note not without a struggle. The next such note he changed to buy provisions for a family dinner, costing 28 rubles, and though he remembered that 28 rubles was the price of 9 chetverts of oats, mown, bound into sheaves, threshed, winnowed, sifted, and shovelled with sweat and groans, nevertheless it went more easily than the first. The notes he now changed no longer evoked such calculations, but flew away like wee birds. Whether the pleasure afforded by what it purchased corresponded to the labour expended in acquiring the money was a consideration long since lost sight of. His farming calculations, that there is a price below which certain grain must not be sold, were forgotten too. The rye, after he had so long held out for a certain price, was sold 50 kopecks a chetvert cheaper than had been offered him a month ago. Even the calculation that it would be impossible to live for a year at that rate of expenditure without running into debt, even that calculation had lost its meaning. The one thing needful was to have money in the bank without asking whence it came, so as to be always sure of the wherewithal to get tomorrow's beef. Till now he had always observed that rule. He had always had money in the bank. But now he had no money remaining there, and did not quite know where to get any. It was this that had upset him for a moment when Kitty reminded him about money. However, he had no time to think about it. While driving, he thought of Katavasov and of making Metrov's acquaintance. Chapter 3. During his stay in Moscow, Levin had renewed his intimacy with his fellow student of university days, now Professor Katavasov, whom he had not seen since his marriage. He liked Katavasov because of his clear and simple outlook on life. Levin thought Katavasov's clear outlook resulted from the poverty of his nature, and Katavasov thought Levin's inconsequential opinions resulted from a lack of mental discipline. But Katavasov's clarity pleased Levin, and the abundance of Levin's undisciplined thoughts pleased Katavasov, so they liked to meet and argue. Levin had read some parts of his book to Katavasov, who liked it. Happening to meet Levin at a public lecture the previous day, Katavasov had told him that the celebrated Metrov, whose article had so pleased Levin, was in Moscow, and was much interested in what Katavasov had told him of Levin's work, that he would be at his house next day about 11 in the morning, and would be very pleased to make Levin's acquaintance.
"Decidedly, you are improving.
Quite a pleasure to see it," said Katavasov, as he welcomed Levin in the little drawing-room. "I heard the bell and thought, it's impossible he can have come punctually."
"Well, what do you think of the Montenegrins? They are born warriors.
"What's happened?" asked Levin. Katavasov, in a few words, told him the latest news, and, taking him into the study, introduced Levin to a tall, sturdy, and very agreeable-looking man. It was Metrov. The conversation rested for a time on politics and on how the highest circles in Petersburg regarded the latest events. Metrov quoted words on the subject attributed to the emperor and one of the ministers, which he had from a reliable source. Katavasov, however, had heard with equal definiteness that the emperor said something quite different. Levin tried to imagine a situation in which both utterances might have been made, and the subject was dropped. "He has written almost a book on the natural condition of the labourer in relation to the land," said Katavasov. "I am not a specialist, but as a naturalist, I liked his not taking humanity as something outside zoological laws, but on the contrary regarding it as dependent on its surroundings, and searching in this dependence for the laws of its development."
"That is very interesting," said Metrov.
"I really began to write a book on agriculture, but being occupied with the chief instrument in agriculture, the labourer," said Levin with a blush, "I involuntarily arrived at quite unexpected results."
And Levin began carefully, as if feeling his way, to expound his views. He knew that Metrov had written an article running counter to the generally accepted teachings of political economy, but how far he could hope for his sympathy with his own novel views Levin did not know, and could not gather from the expression of the professor's quiet and intelligent face.
"But in what do you perceive the peculiar quality of the Russian worker?" asked Metrov. "In his zoological qualities, so to say, or in the conditions in which he's placed?"
Levin detected in this very question a thought with which he did not agree, but he continued to expound his view, which was that the Russian labourer's view of the land is quite different from that of other nations. To illustrate this theory, he hastened to add that, in his opinion, the Russian people's view results from their consciousness of a vocation to populate the vast, unoccupied tracts in the East.
"It is easy to be led astray when drawing conclusions as to the general vocation of a people," said Metrov, interrupting Levin. "The condition of the labourer will always depend on his relation to land and capital."
And without letting Levin finish explaining his idea, Metrov began expounding to him the peculiarity of his own teaching. What that peculiarity consisted in, Levin did not understand, because he did not even try to do so. He saw that Metrov, like the others, despite the article in which he refused the teachings of the economists, still regarded the position of the Russian labourer merely from the standpoint of capital, wages, and rent, though he had to admit that in the eastern and greater part of Russia rents were still nil, that wages, for 9/10 of the 80 millions of the Russian population, represented only sustenance for themselves, and that capital did not yet exist except in the form of most primitive tools. Yet he regarded every labourer merely from that one point of view, though on many points he disagreed with the economists and had his own theory of wages, which he explained to Levin. Levin listened reluctantly and at first made objections. He wanted to interrupt Metrov and to state his own idea, which he considered would render a further statement of Metrov's view superfluous. But afterwards, having convinced himself that they looked at the question so differently that they would never understand one another, he ceased making objections and merely listened. Though what Metrov was saying now no longer interested him at all, he felt some pleasure, all the same, in hearing him. His vanity was flattered by the fact that so learned a man should explain his opinions to him so willingly, so carefully, and with such faith in Levin's knowledge of the subject, that he sometimes by a mere hint indicated a whole aspect of the matter. Levin attributed this to his own worth, not knowing that Metrov, who had exhausted the matter with all his intimates, was particularly pleased to speak about it to any fresh person, and, in general, willingly spoke to everybody about the subject with which he was occupied, and which was not yet clear to himself.
"I'm afraid we shall be late," said Katavasov, glancing at the clock as soon as Metrov had finished his disquisition.
Yes, there is a meeting of the Society of Amateurs in honour of Svintichi's Jubilee, Katavasov went on, in relation to Levin's inquiry. Pyotr Ivanovich, Metrov, and I have arranged to go. I have promised to read a paper on his work on zoology. Oh, come with us, it will be very interesting.
Yes, it is quite time, remarked Metrov.
Come with us, and then, if you care to, come home with me. I should very much like to hear your work.
Oh, no, it is still so unfinished, but I shall be pleased to go to the meeting.
And have you heard?
I gave in a separate report,
Katavasov called out from the next room, where he was changing his coat. They began a conversation about a controversy in the university, which was one of the most important events in Moscow that winter. The three old professors on the council had not accepted the opinion of the younger ones. The younger ones presented a separate resolution. This resolution was, in the opinion of some people, a dreadful one, while according to others it was very simple and just. The professors were divided into two camps. The side to which Katavasov belonged accused their opponents of mean treachery and deception, while the others imputed youthfulness and disrespect for authority. Levin, though he did not belong to the university, had since his arrival in Moscow more than once heard and conversed about this affair, and had formed his own opinion on the subject, and he took part in the conversation which was continued in the street until they all three arrived at the old university buildings. The meeting had already begun. At the table, covered with a cloth at which Katavasov and Metrov took their seats, six men were sitting, and one of them, with his head bent close over a manuscript, was reading something. Levin took one of the vacant chairs which were standing round the table, and in a whisper asked a student who was sitting there what was being read. With a displeased look at Levin, the student replied, "The biography." Though the biography of the scientist did not interest Levin, he listened involuntarily and learnt a few interesting facts about the celebrated man's life. When the reader had finished, the chairman thanked him and read aloud some verses for the jubilee sent by the poet Ment, adding a few words of thanks to the poet. Then Katavasov, in his loud, strident voice, read his paper on the scientific work of the man whose jubilee it was. When Katavasov had finished, Levin looked at his watch, saw that it was getting on for two, and thought that there would be no time to read his manuscript to Metrov before the concert, and besides, he no longer felt inclined to do so. During the readings, he had also been thinking about the talk they had had. It was now clear to him that though Metrov's views might perhaps be of importance, his own ideas were of importance too, and these views could be formulated and lead to results only if each of them worked separately along the lines he had selected, but communicating them to one another could not lead to any result. Making up his mind to decline Metrov's invitation, therefore, Levin approached him as soon as the meeting ended. Metrov introduced him to the chairman with whom he was discussing the political news. In this connection, Metrov told the chairman the same thing that he had already told Levin, and Levin made the same remarks as he had made in the morning, but for the sake of diversity expressed also a new view of his own, which had but just entered his head. After that, they began talking about the university question. As Levin had already heard all that, he hastened to tell Metrov that he regretted he was unable to accept his invitation, shook hands, and drove off to the Lyovovs.
Chapter 4 Lyovov, who was married to Kitty's sister Natalie, had passed all his life in the capitals and abroad, where he had been educated and where he had been in the diplomatic service. The year before, he had quitted the diplomatic service, not because of any unpleasantness, he never had unpleasantness with anyone, but had exchanged into the Moscow court ministry in order to be able to give his boys the best education. Despite very acute differences in their habits and opinions, and the fact that Lyovov was older than Levin, they became very intimate and attached to one another that winter. Levin found Lyovov at home and entered unannounced. Wearing an indoor jacket with a belt, Morocco leather shoes, and with a pince-nez of blue glass on his nose, Lyovov sat in an easy chair reading a book lying on a lectern before him,
and carefully held at a distance in his shapely hand a cigar half turned to ashes. His handsome, refined, and still young-looking face, to which the curly, glossy, silver hair gave a still more well-bred appearance, lit up with a smile when he saw Levin.
"Good, and I was just going to send to you. Well, and how's Kitty? Oh, take this chair, it's more comfortable."
He rose and pushed forward a rocking chair.
"Have you read the last circular in the Journal de St. Petersburg? I think it's splendid," said he, with a slightly French accent.
Levin told him what he had heard from Katavasov of what was said in Petersburg, and after some talk on politics, Levin recounted how he had made Metrov's acquaintance and had gone to the meeting.
"This interested Lyubov very much. There now, I envy you for having the entrance to that interesting scientific world," he said. And having started talking, he changed, as he usually did, into French, which he spoke more easily. "It's true I have no time to spare. My work and occupation with the children deprive me of that. Besides, I am not ashamed to confess that my education was far too insufficient."
"I don't think so," said Levin with a smile, feeling as usual touched by the other's low opinion of himself, which was not in the least affected from desire to appear, or even to be, modest, but was quite sincere.
"Oh, yes, I now feel how little educated I am. Even for the children's lessons I often have to refresh my memory, or even simply to learn things. For it is not enough to have masters. One must have a supervisor as well, just as you have both labourers and an overseer on your estate."
"I was just reading." And he showed Levin Baslava's grammar, which lay on the lectern.
"They expect Misha to know this, and it is so difficult. Will you explain this to me? He says here..."
Levin tried to explain that it was impossible to understand it, and that it must just be learnt by heart. But Lyubov did not agree with him.
"Yes, you laugh at it. On the contrary, you have no idea how, when I see you, I am always learning what awaits me, the education of my children."
"Oh, come, you've nothing to learn from me," said Lyubov.
"All I know is that I never saw better brought-up children than yours," said Levin, "and do not wish for better children."
Lyubov evidently tried to restrain the expression of his delight, but a radiant smile lit up his face.
"If only they turn out better than I, that is all I desire. You do not yet know all the difficulties one has with boys who, like mine, have been neglected through our life abroad," said he. "They'll catch it all up. They're such gifted children. The chief thing is the moral training. That is what I learned by watching your children." "You talk of moral training? You can't imagine how difficult that is. You have hardly mastered one fault when another crops up and there is a fresh struggle."
"One must have the support of religion. You remember our talk about that?
No father relying on his own strength without that support could educate a child."
This conversation on a topic that always interested Levin was cut short by the entrance of the beautiful Natalie Alexandrovna, who came in dressed to go out.
"Oh, I didn't know you were here," she said,
evidently not at all sorry, but rather pleased at having interrupted a conversation which she had heard long ago, and of which she was weary.
"And how is Kitty? I am dining with you today. Look here, Arseny," she said, turning to her husband. "You will take the carriage."
And husband and wife began discussing what they would do that day. As the husband had to go and meet someone officially, and the wife was going to the concert and then to a public meeting of the Southeastern Committee, there was much to decide and arrange. Levin, as one of the family, had to take part in the deliberations. It was settled that Levin would drive with Natalie to the concert and to the public meeting, and from there they would send the carriage to the office to fetch Arseny, who would call for his wife and take her on to Kitty's, or if he was detained by business, he would send the carriage back, and Levin would accompany her. "He spoils me, you know," said Lyubov to his wife, indicating Levin. "He assures me that our children are splendid, though I see so much that is bad in them."
"Arseny goes to extremes, as I always tell him," said his wife. "If you look for perfection, you will never be satisfied. What Papa says is perfectly true. When we were brought up, they went to one extreme and kept us children in the attics while our parents lived on the first floor. But now it's just the reverse. The lumber room for the parents and the first floor for the children." Nowadays, parents are hardly allowed to live, and everything is for the children.
Why not, if that is pleasanter? Said Lyovov, with his handsome smile, touching her hand.
Those who don't know you would think you were not a mother, but a stepmother.
No, extremes are not right in any case, said Natalie, quietly, putting his paper knife in its right place on the table.
Ah, come here, you perfect children, said Lyovov, to two little boys who, after bowing to Lievin, approached their father, evidently wishing to ask him something.
Lievin wanted to talk to them and hear what they would say to their father, but Natalie spoke to him, and then Makhotin, a fellow official of Lyovov's, came in court uniform to fetch Lyovov to meet someone, and an unending conversation began about Gersagovina, the Princess Korzinskaya, the Duma, and the Countess Apraxina's sudden death. Lievin had forgotten the commission he had been charged with, and only remembered it when on his way to the anteroom.
"Oh, Kitty wished me to have a talk with you about Oblonsky," he said, when Lyovov paused on the stairs as he was seeing his wife and Lievin down.
"Yes, yes, Maman wishes us, les beaux-frères, to come down on him," said Lyovov, blushing.
"But why should I?"
"Well, then, I will be down on him," said his wife, smiling, as she stood in her white, fur-lined cloak, waiting for them to finish their talk.
"Come, let us go."
Chapter 5. At the matinee concert, there were two very interesting items. One was King Lear on the Heath, a fantasia, and the other was a quartet dedicated to the memory of Bach. Both pieces were new and in the new style, and Lievin wished to form an opinion on them. When he had conducted his sister-in-law to her seat, he took his station behind a pillar, resolved to listen as attentively and as conscientiously as possible. He tried not to let his mind wander, nor to let his impression of the music be marred by looking at the white-tied conductor's arm-waving, which always so unpleasantly distracts one's attention from the music, nor by the ladies with their bonnets, the ribbons of which were so carefully tied over their ears for the concert, nor by all those other persons who were either not interested in anything or were interested in all sorts of things other than music. He carefully avoided the musical experts and great talkers and stood with lowered eyes gazing straight before him, listening. But the longer he listened to the King Lear fantasia, the further he felt from the possibility of forming any definite opinion. The musical expression of some emotion seemed perpetually on the point of beginning when it suddenly broke into fragments of the expression of other emotions, or even into unrelated sounds which, elaborate though they were only connected by the whim of the composer. Even these fragments of musical expression, though some of them were good, were unpleasing because they were quite unexpected and unprepared for. Mirth, sadness, despair, tenderness, triumph came forth without any cause, like the thoughts of a madman. And as in the mind of a madman, these emotions vanished just as unexpectedly. Throughout the performance, Lievin felt like a deaf person watching a dance. He was quite perplexed when the music stopped and felt very tired as a result of strained attention, quite unrewarded. From all sides came loud applause. Everyone rose, began to walk about and to talk. Wishing to clear up his own perplexity by hearing other people's impressions, Lievin went to look for the experts, and was pleased to find a celebrated one chatting with his own acquaintance, Pestsov.
"Wonderful," Pestsov was saying in his deep bass. "How do you do, Konstantin Dmitrich? Especially shapely, plastic, and rich in colour, if one may say so, is the passage where you feel the approach of Cordelia, the woman, das ewige Weibliche, and she enters upon a struggle with fate."
"Why, what has Cordelia to do with it?" Lievin asked timidly, having quite forgotten that the fantasia presented King Lear on the Heath.
"Cordelia appears here," said Pestsov,
tapping with his fingers the glossy program he was holding and handing it to Lievin. Only then did Lievin recollect the title of the fantasia and hasten to read the Russian translation of a passage from Shakespeare which was printed on the back.
"You can't follow without it,"
said Pestsov, turning to Lievin, as the man he had been talking to had gone away and he had no one else to talk to. During the interval, Lievin and Pestsov began a discussion on the merits and defects of the Wagnerian tendency in music. Lievin maintained that the mistake of Wagner and of all his followers lay in trying to make music enter the domain of another art, and that poetry commits the same error when it depicts the features of a face, which should be done by painting. And as an example of this kind of error, he mentioned a sculptor who tried to chisel the shadows of poetic images arising round the pedestal of his statue of a poet. "The sculptor's shadows so little resembled shadows that they even clung to a ladder," said Lievin. He liked this phrase, but could not remember whether he had not used it before, and to Pestsov himself, and after saying it he grew embarrassed. Pestsov argued that art was all one, and that it can only reach its highest manifestations by uniting all the different kinds of art. Lievin could not listen to the second part of the concert, for Pestsov, who stood beside him, talked all the while and found fault with the piece because of its unnecessary and sickly affectation of simplicity, comparing it with the simplicities of the Pre-Raphaelite school of painting. On going out, Lievin met several other acquaintances, with whom he talked about politics, music, and mutual friends. Among others, he met Count Boll. He had quite forgotten his intended visit to him. "We'll then go at once," said the Princess Lyovova, to whom he mentioned the matter. "Perhaps they won't receive you, and then call for me at the meeting. You have time enough."
Chapter 6.
"Perhaps they don't receive today," said Lievin as he entered the hall of Countess Boll's house. "They do. Please walk in," said the hall porter, determinedly helping him off with his overcoat. "What a nuisance," thought Lievin with a sigh as he pulled off one glove and smoothed his hat. "What is the good of my going in? And what on earth am I to say to them?" As he entered the first drawing room, he met in the doorway the Countess Boll, who, with an anxious and stern expression, was giving orders to a servant. When she saw Lievin, she smiled and asked him into the next room, a smaller drawing room, whence came the sound of voices. In that room, seated in armchairs, were the Countess's two daughters and a Moscow colonel with whom Lievin was acquainted. Lievin went up to them, said, "How do you do?" and sat down on a chair beside the sofa, holding his hat in his hand. "How is your wife? Have you been to the concert? We could not go. Mama had to attend the funeral."
"Yes, I have heard."
"How sudden it was," said Lievin. The Countess came in and sat down on the sofa, and she too inquired about his wife and about the concert. Lievin answered and repeated his remark about the suddenness of the Countess Apraxina's death. "But she always was delicate." "Were you at the opera last night?"
"Yes, I was."
"Wasn't Luca splendid?"
"Yes, splendid," he replied.
And as he was quite indifferent to what they might think of him, he repeated what they had heard hundreds of times about the peculiarities of that singer's talent. The Countess Boll pretended to be listening. When he had said enough and paused, the colonel, who till then had kept silent, began also to talk about the opera and about the lighting of the opera house. At length, having mentioned the Folle Journée that was being got up at Turin's, he laughed, rose noisily, and went away. Lievin rose too, but saw by the Countess's face that it was not yet time for him to leave. He had to endure another minute or two, so he sat down again. As, however, he kept on thinking how silly it was, he found nothing to speak about and remained silent. "You are not going to the public meeting? They say it will be very interesting," began the Countess.
"No, but I promised my sister-in-law to call for her there," said Lievin.
There was a pause, and the mother exchanged glances with her daughter. "Well, I expect it's time now," thought Lievin, and rose. The ladies shook hands with him and asked him to tell his wife mille choses from them. The hall porter, as he helped him on with his overcoat, asked where he was staying, and at once entered his address in a large, well-bound book. "Of course, it's all the same to me, but still it makes one ashamed, and it's awfully stupid," thought Levin, comforting himself with the reflection that everybody does it. And he went on to the meeting of the committee, where he had to meet his sister-in-law in order to accompany her to his own home. At the meeting of the committee there were a great many people and almost the whole of society. Levin was in time to hear a summary which everybody said was very interesting. When that had been read, the society folk gathered into a group, and Levin met Sviazhsky, who asked him to be sure and come that evening to a meeting of the Agricultural Society where an important report was to be read. He also met Oblonsky, who had just come from the races, and many other persons he knew. Levin again expressed and heard various opinions about the meeting, the new fantasia, and a trial. But probably as a result of the mental fatigue he was beginning to feel, he made a slip when talking of the trial, and he afterwards remembered that slip with vexation several times. Speaking of the punishment awaiting a foreigner who was being tried in Russia, and of how unjust it would be to banish him from the country, Levin repeated what he had heard said the day before by a man he knew. "It seems to me that to send him abroad would be like punishing a pike by throwing it into the water," said Levin, and only afterwards remembered that that thought, apparently given out as his own, and which he had heard from his acquaintance, was taken from one of Krylov's fables, and that his acquaintance had repeated it from a feuilleton. Having conducted his sister-in-law to his house, where he found Kitty cheerful and quite all right, Levin went off to the club.
Chapter 7 Levin arrived at the club in good time. Members and visitors were driving up as he got there. He had long not been there, not since the days when, after leaving the university, he had lived in Moscow and gone out into society. He remembered the club and the external details of its rooms, but had quite forgotten the impression it then made upon him. But as soon as he entered the semicircular courtyard, got out of his sledge and entered the porch, where he was met by a hall porter with a shoulder belt, who noiselessly opened the door and bowed to him, as soon as he saw in the hall the coats and galoshes of those of the members who realized that it was easier to take off their galoshes downstairs than to go up in them, and as soon as he heard the mysterious ring of the bell that announced his ascent, and while mounting the shallow steps of the carpeted stairs perceived the statue on the landing, and saw upstairs the third hall porter in club livery, whom he recognized, though the man had aged, who opened the door for him without haste or delay, gazing at the new arrival, directly he saw all this, Levin was enveloped in the old familiar atmosphere of the place, an atmosphere of repose, ease, and propriety.
"Let me have your hat, sir,"
said the porter to Levin, who had forgotten the club rule that hats must be left at the entrance.
"It's a long time since you were here. The prince entered your name yesterday. Prince Oblonsky is not here yet."
This hall porter not only knew Levin, but knew all his connections and relatives as well, and at once mentioned some of his intimate friends. Passing first through a room in which were several screens, and then a room on the right in which was a partition and a fruit stall, Levin, having overtaken and passed an old man who was walking slowly, entered the noisy and crowded dining room. He passed among the tables, which were nearly all occupied, surveying the guests. Here and there he came across all sorts of people he knew, old and young, some whom he only just knew, and some with whom he was intimate. There was not one angry or anxious face among them. All seemed to have left their cares and anxieties behind them in the hall with their hats, and to be preparing to enjoy the material blessings of life at their leisure. Sviazhsky and Shcherbatsky, Nevedovsky and the old prince, Vronsky and Koznishev, all were there.
"Why are you so late?"
asked the old prince with a smile, holding out his hand over his shoulder.
"How's Kitty?"
he added, smoothing the table napkin, which he had tucked in behind a button of his waistcoat.
"She's all right. They're all three dining together." "Ah, Arlene's Nardine's. Well, there's no room at our table. Go to that table and be quick and secure a seat," said the old prince.
And turning away, he carefully took a plate of fish soup that was handed to him.
"Levin! Here!"
shouted someone a little farther off in a kindly voice. It was Turovtsin.
He sat beside a young military man, and two chairs were tilted against their table. Lievin joined them with pleasure. He always liked that good-natured spendthrift, Turovtsin. With him was associated the memory of his proposal to Kitty. But today, after all those strained intellectual conversations, Turovtsin's good-natured face was particularly welcome.
"These are for you and Oblonsky. He will be here in a minute."
The military man, with merry, ever-laughing eyes, who held himself very erect, was Gagin from Petersburg. Turovtsin introduced him.
"Oblonsky is always late."
"Ah, here he is."
"Have you just come?"
asked Oblonsky, hastening toward them.
"How do you do?
Had any vodka?
Well then, come."
Lievin rose and went with him to a large table on which stood various kinds of vodka and a very varied assortment of hors d'oeuvre. It might have been thought that from a score of different hors d'oeuvre it would be possible to select one to any taste, but Oblonsky ordered something special, and one of the liveried footmen brought it at once. They drank a glass of vodka each and returned to their table. While they were still at their soup, Gagin ordered a bottle of champagne and had four glasses filled. Lievin did not refuse the proffered wine and ordered another bottle. He was hungry and ate and drank with great pleasure, and with still greater pleasure took part in the simple, merry talk of his companions. Gagin, lowering his voice, related a new Petersburg anecdote which, though it was indecent and stupid, was so funny that Lievin burst into loud laughter and people turned to look at him.
"That's in the style of the story. That's just what I can't bear. Do you know it?" asked Oblonsky. "Oh, it's delightful. Bring another bottle," he called to the waiter, and immediately began telling the story.
"With Pyotr Ilyich Vinovsky's compliments," interrupted an old waiter, bringing two delicate glasses of still sparkling champagne on a tray and addressing Oblonsky and Lievin.
Oblonsky took a glass, and exchanging a look with a bald, red-haired man with a moustache who sat at the other end of their table, smilingly nodded to him.
"Who is that?" inquired Lievin. "You once met him at my house, do you remember? A nice fellow."
Lievin followed Oblonsky's example and took the glass. Oblonsky's anecdote was very amusing, too. Then Lievin told one, which also was appreciated. Then they talked about horses, about that day's races, and how gallantly Vronsky's Atlas Nyi had won the first prize. Lievin hardly noticed how the dinner passed.
"Ah, here they are,"
said Oblonsky, just as they were finishing, leaning back in his chair and stretching out his hand to Vronsky, who was approaching with a tall colonel of the guards. Vronsky's face, too, was lit up by the general pleasant good humour of the club. Gaily leaning his arm on Oblonsky's shoulder, he whispered something to him, and with the same merry smile held out a hand to Lievin.
"Very glad to meet you," he said. "I looked for you that day at the elections, but was told you had already left."
"Yes, I left that same day. We were just speaking about your horse."
"I congratulate you," said Lievin. "That was quick running."
"Oh, yes.
You keep racehorses, too?"
"No. My father did, and I remember them and know something about them."
"Where did you dine?" asked Oblonsky.
"At the second table, behind the pillars."
"He has been congratulated," remarked the colonel. "It's the second time he's won the Imperial Prize. If only I had the luck at cards that he has with horses. But why waste the golden moments? I'm off to the infernal regions," added he, and walked away.
"That's Yashvin," said Vronsky in reply to Turovtsin's question as he took a vacant chair beside them. He drank a glass of champagne they offered him, and ordered another bottle. Whether influenced by the club or by the wine he had drunk, Lievin chatted with Vronsky about the best breeds of cattle, and was very pleased to find that he had not the least animosity toward the man. He even told Vronsky, among other things, that he had heard from his wife that she had met him at the Princess Maria Borisovna's.
"Oh, the Princess Maria Borisovna, isn't she charming?" cried Oblonsky,
and related an anecdote about her which made them all laugh. Vronsky especially burst into such good-natured laughter that Lievin felt quite reconciled to him.
"Well, have you finished?"
asked Oblonsky, rising and smiling.
Let's go.
Chapter 8. On leaving the table, Levin, feeling that as he went his arms swung with unusual regularity and ease, passed with Gagin through the lofty apartments to the billiard room. When they had traversed the large hall, he met his father-in-law.
"Well, and how do you like our temple of idleness?" said the prince, giving him his arm. "Come, let's walk about a little."
"Yes, a walk is just what I want, and to have a look round. It interests me."
"Yes, it interests you, but my interest is different to yours." "You look at those old men," said the prince, indicating a round-shouldered member with a hanging nether lip, hardly able to shuffle along in his soft boots, who met and passed them. "And you imagine they were born schlupiks?"
"Schlupiks? What's that?"
"You see, you don't even know the word. It is a club term. You know the game of egg rolling? Well, an egg that has been rolled very often becomes a schlupik. And so it is with ourselves. We keep coming and coming to the club until we turn into schlupiks."
"Now you're laughing. But we are already thinking of how we shall become schlupiks."
"You know Prince Chechensky?" asked the prince,
and Levin saw by his face that he was going to say something droll.
"No, I don't."
"You don't? What, the well-known Prince Chechensky? Well, never mind. He is always playing billiards, you know. 3 years ago he was not yet among the schlupiks, and he showed a bold front, calling others schlupiks. Well, one day he arrives, and our hall porter, you know Vasily, oh yes, that fat one, he's a great wit. Well, Prince Chechensky asks him, 'I say, Vasily, who is here, any of the schlupiks?' And Vasily replies, 'Well, yes, you're the third one.'"
"Yes, my lad, that's how it is."
Chatting and exchanging greetings with acquaintances they chanced to meet, Levin and the prince passed through all the rooms. The large one, in which card tables were already arranged and habitual partners were playing for small stakes, the sofa room where they were playing chess and where Koznishev sat talking to someone, the billiard room where, by a sofa in a recess, a merry party, which included Gagin, were drinking champagne. They looked in at the infernal regions, too, where round a table, at which Yashvin had already taken his seat, crowded a number of backers. Taking care not to make a noise, they entered the dim reading room, where, under shaded lamps, a young man with an angry countenance sat turning over one newspaper after another, and a bald general was engrossed in what he was reading. They also went into the room which the prince termed the wise room. There, three gentlemen were arguing about the latest political news.
"Will you come, Prince? Everything is ready," said one of his habitual partners, finding him there, and the prince went away.
Levin sat down for a while and listened, but remembering all the conversations he had that day heard, he suddenly felt terribly bored. He rose hastily and went to look for Oblonsky and Turovtsin, with whom he had felt merry. Turovtsin, with a tankard of something to drink, was sitting on the high sofa in the billiard room, and Oblonsky was talking to Vronsky by the door in the far corner. "She is not exactly dull, but that indefinite, unsettled position," Levin overheard, and was hastening away when Oblonsky called him.
"Levin," said he.
And Levin noticed that though in Oblonsky's eyes there were not actually tears, they were moist, as they always were when he had been drinking or when he felt touched. Today it was both.
"Levin, don't go,"
he said, holding him tightly by the elbow, evidently not wishing to let him go on any account.
"This is my true, almost my best friend," he said to Vronsky. "You two are even more near and dear to me. And I want you to be friends, and I know that you will be friendly and intimate, because you are both good fellows."
"Well, then, there's nothing for it but to kiss and be friends," said Vronsky, good-naturedly jesting and holding out his hand.
He quickly grasped Levin's outstretched hand and pressed it.
"I am very, very glad," said Levin, pressing Vronsky's hand.
"Waiter! Bring a bottle of champagne," said Oblonsky.
"And I am glad, too," said Vronsky.
But in spite of Oblonsky's wish and theirs, they had nothing to say to one another, and both knew it.
"You know, he's not acquainted with Anna," said Oblonsky to Vronsky. "And I particularly wish to take him to see her. Let's go, Levin."
"Really," said Vronsky, "she will be very glad. I would go home at once, but I am anxious about Yashvin and want to stay here till he has finished."
"Oh, is he in a bad way?"
"He keeps on losing, and I alone can restrain him."
"Then what do you say to pyramids?
Levin, will you play?"
"Oh, capital," said Oblonsky.
"Place the balls for pyramids," he added, turning to the billiard marker.
"They have been ready a long time," replied the marker, who had already placed the balls in a triangle and was rolling the red ball about to pass the time.
"Yeah, come along."
After the game, Vronsky and Levin joined Gagin at his table, and at Oblonsky's invitation, Levin began betting on aces. Vronsky sat beside the table, surrounded by friends who were continually coming to him, or else went to the infernal regions to see what Yashvin was up to. Levin experienced an agreeable sense of relief from the mental weariness of the morning. He was glad the hostility between Vronsky and himself was ended, and the impression of tranquillity, decorum, and pleasure did not leave him. When they had finished their play, Oblonsky took Levin's arm.
"Well then, let us go to Anna's. Now, at once. She will be at home. I promised her long ago to bring you. Where were you going tonight?"
"Nowhere in particular. I had promised Sviatsky to go to the Agricultural Society's meeting, but I'll come with you if you like," replied Levin.
"Capital! Let's go. Find out whether my carriage has come," said Oblonsky to a footman.
Levin went to the table, paid the 40 rubles he had lost betting on the aces, paid the club bill to an old footman who stood by the door, and who seemed in some miraculous way to know what it came to, and, swinging his arms in a peculiar way, passed through the whole suite of rooms to the exit. Chapter 9
"The Oblonsky carriage!" shouted
the hall porter in a stern bass. The carriage drove up and they got in. Only for the first few moments, while they were leaving the courtyard of the club, did Levin retain that sense of club calm, pleasure, and undoubted decorum in his surroundings. But as soon as the carriage had passed out into the street and he felt it jolting on the uneven road, heard the angry shouts of an izvozchik they met, saw in the ill-lit street the red signboards of a vodka dealer and of a small shop, that sense was dissipated, and he began to consider his actions and to ask himself whether he was doing right in going to see Anna. What would Kitty say? But Oblonsky would not let him reflect, and as if guessing his doubts, tried to dispel them.
"How glad I am that you will make her acquaintance," said he. "Do you know, Dolly has long wished it, and Lyovov called on her and goes to see her. Though she is my sister," Oblonsky continued, "I may safely say that she is a remarkable woman. Well, you'll see. Her position is a very trying one, especially just now."
"Why especially just now?"
"We are negotiating with her husband about a divorce. He agrees, but there are difficulties about her son, and the affair, which should have been ended long ago, has already been dragging on for 3 months. As soon as she gets the divorce, she will marry Vronsky. How stupid that old ceremony is, walking round and round singing 'Rejoice, Isaiah,' a ceremony in which nobody believes and which stands in the way of people's happiness," interpolated Oblonsky. "Well, and then their position will be as definite as mine or yours."
"What is the difficulty?" asked